Since you have a long relativity lecture, we'll start with a joke. How do I tell that joke? It started with this guy called Larry David. It's pretty old, and who knows anything about Larry David? Larry David? It's a comedy guy. It's somehow important for our joke. Says that I have to get it. Okay. So Larry David used to like to drink tea when he's in the bathtub.
Really?
How would I know? And then after he got divorced, that's at least true in the show, then he can't do it anymore.
Why?
I kind of see it, but I can tell you. Because nature forbids this. All right, back on topic. So I want to say is yesterday I received a very good question. It's really good question because basically as soon as I received the question, I was like, how come I didn't think about this question? And furthermore, how come the last 4 years of students didn't think of this question? Like it's a tutorial has been run for the fifth year and I got this really, really physical and a nice, brilliant question from Jackie and Alexandra. They say, if we have a helicity look like this, I can solve the eigenvalue equation to get two eigenvectors for like h equals plus half. But this is very bad. This is very bad. They say, but we were told if you are massless while then you have a definite handedness, how could you get both solution? This is a very good question. I'm very amazed by this question, so I look into it and got some answer. So that means there's going to be some appendix solution to the tutorial, which I should have asked. So this question will made it to the next year to the tutorial if I'm still teaching this course. And the other question many of you have asked says, why do we use this, mundane inner product thing to argue about the rotation? Why shouldn't we just compute this because we have Lorentz algebra? That's also a very good question. And I take the challenge and compute it. So I'll also upload it. And you can see if it's rotation, it's going to be zero. If it's boost, it's not. Just as you expected from the experience. Okay, dense L is Z quiz, and it has a quiz to go with it. So by Tuesday, we really need this. You either somehow really understand the dense L is Z, or do the quiz, understand the L is Z, or do both. But like I really want you to know his L is Z inside out. Otherwise, we're gonna be trying to, walk in mud in that lecture, which is very bad because that lecture is already, I think, at the time limit. If we do many, many trippings, we're not gonna get there.
Wait, so, there's a quiz that was from the quantum theory course?
No, it's a new quiz, then specially written for me. And it was so hard that I can't get it all right. So yes, it's called a dance quiz because he wrote it, And that quiz, like among all the must do quiz, this is like maybe the first one, the number one quiz. Okay. And it's very, like for the last quiz, as you can see, I don't have time, so I haven't checked anybody who do or not. But if you want to skip those quizzes and leap into this one, I'm okay with that. And please do it before Tuesday.
What's it called?
It's called...
Is it called the calculation?
No, that's something else. It should be above the calculation. Probably called it something like LCC something. Review of a scalar field interaction, something like that. If you tell, see, I don't remember anything. So there is a must-do quiz at the end of this week, which is not the calculation, but that calculation is also very, very important because it tells you how operator is in terms of field. That's basically what you need to do LIC. You have seen something like A is some like a Klein-Gordon acting on phi. So that calculation is try to do this for the Fermi theory. It's also very important. Okay, I want to say a little bit about what we did. I hope you find it enlightening, or maybe confusing, or maybe both. But I want to emphasize that what I want to say about the handed is basically my point is, if somebody come to you says some handed fermion, okay, my discussion will exclude the neutrino and decide they are massless. That's what everybody talk about the standard model, do that assumption. Neutrino mass belongs to beyond the standard model. Okay, if someone comes to you says, I have a handed fermion, also excludes the right-handed neutron. And you should ask, who? And when? And if the answer is not whoever and whenever, then they're not talking about a left-handed or right-handed fermion. It needs to be any observable and any time. So this tells us it's Lorentz invariant, that tells us it's conserved. So you have to be correctly answer both questions to be a well fermion. Well, then I just realized if I have those, I'll ask about what? And you know that gamma 5 will give you some projection operators. And you can ask where. It's actually everywhere. It's just, you know, all bundled in the Dirac field.
What do you mean by whoever?
Whoever means any observable, any observer, any person has to say agree with the handedness. Otherwise, it's not a good definition. This one says one observer, whenever look at it, it better give me the same handedness. Otherwise, it's not a very, very good definition. And you can ask some other question like where, I would say wherever. Because in principle, if you take standard model, you would say the standard model is made of wild fermions, not a Dirac. And then you'll say why. And this is a cliffhanger that to standard model, you have to learn about a weak interaction. And then the last question is how? Can I actually change a wild fermion from left-handed to the right-handed? Okay, this will deal with the Monday lecture, I'll tell you one way, and the Monday tutorial, I'll tell the other way.
Wait, sorry, can you explain like the what and the whenever or wherever?
So what is how do you get a well fermion? You use projection operators. Where is, look, there are a bunch of well fermions in this, whole bunch. They might look like a Dirac fermion, but you just go to high energy, they are all well fermions. They're just interacting and then combine them together to give you a Dirac fermion. And the how is just say you have a left-handed well fermion, you have a right-handed well fermion. Can you actually do something to switch you can. There are two ways, but we're not going to talk about it until Monday. And the last thing I want to say about them is that here is an interview calculation. In the interview, you need to be able to compute this. Okay? And I'll tell you the result is zero. I'm not going to compute it because I'll see that from you in the interview. And the point is, if that's actually zero, which tells us indeed, well, fermion is always massless, then you would say Dirac mass, well, had better come from somewhere. I'll say contains a term, and there is the other term, but I'm too lazy to write. So contains a term look like this, and the other one with plus minus switched. So Dirac fermion mass comes from the interaction between two different handed well fermions. And you will say this is bizarre. And this is exactly how standard model does it. Okay, all these things besides the circle and that. But from now on, I'm just ranting and give you motivation, of going to standard model class. So this is how standard model does it. There's a Higgs there, and a Higgs takes some VEV because a Higgs has this Mexican hat potential, and the coupling and the VEV together give us mass. So, of course, I want to give you an advertisement for Latham's course. That if you don't know yet, Latham is giving the standard model course, and it's rated as the most pedagogical elective course ever. And he is really trying hard to err on the side of over-clearing things. It's like so crystal clear. Also, he has entertainment that you should ask him to prepare. But anyway, I'm very excited about this. And okay, so that's the, I guess, what we called the unfinished business from yesterday. If you are still sleeping on your well fermions, this is something else about well fermions you want to know about. And you know there is an interview question talk about like well fermions. Okay, so at this time, in order to motivate today's lecture, and I think we're ready for a story by Gunn, but it's actually Dan's story. As soon as I read this story, you wouldn't know. I will never be able to understand English so much to write this thing down. So it involves some islands called the Lilliput and the Blue. I gave up on the other word, Lilliput. How many of you knows about Lilliput? Okay, Lilliput is just island that a bunch of giants live there. Okay, so. In every civilization, there are farmers, and there are people who predict harvests. For example, in Canada, Statistics Canada predicted wheat output in 2022 to 2023 will increase by nearly a million metric tons to 30 million metric tons. On the islands of Lilliput, where everything is epsilon to the dimension times as big, these forecasters are known as quantum field theorists. One year they predicted a terrible famine since a corrupt official was appointed to be the head of the Agriculture Regulation Board. To solve their problem, they ate a regulator. A new regulator was appointed and they redid their calculation. Unsurprisingly, their prediction was regulator independent. clearly stands for. So, quantum field theories. So what do you think we're going to do today?
Regulators.
Quantum field theories. So, okay, the story is written by, I asked him, suppose like people are really small and they work on field, what do we call them? And then that's dance work, become a real story. Anyway, so I like to actually talk about the next three lectures. The next three lectures is called the Trilogy of Interactions. And then the first story is called what? Remember, we haven't write on any interaction Lagrangian, and we'll attempt to do that, and it's not, you know, as easy as this. And the second lecture, second story is of course called LSC, and the last one is called the rules. So if you put them together, you'll get the point. What? LSC rules. So today, we're going to do the prelude. And Dan says, what, you finally got a Lagrangian? Now we're in business. So let's see, the business after Lagrangian is, why do we so desperately find a Lagrangian? And once you have a Lagrangian, what can you do? Then give you a recipe. It's like a step one. Quantization. That's why I said today we're going to be the quantum field theorists. We're going to quantize the field. All right, great. So today the idea. Okay, we're going to have the, so first, the break is going to be later, because I can't stop until we finish all the recipe. Okay. Step one. What did Dan says about step one? So today is you ask me to do things, I'll do it for you. Okay? We'll switch roles. Step one, quantization. What do we do?
Momentum.
Before that?
You have a Lagrangian.
You'd have to have a Lagrangian. Perfect. Then this is our beautiful Lagrangian we found the last time. Okay, so what do you think about this psi? This psi, is it a real or complex? Well, there's a dagger there, right?
Yeah.
If it's real, what is there to dagger for? All right. Small piece of information. Step two. Small step. What's the next step? You have a Lagrangian. It's like from classical physics. You give me a Lagrangian. But we already got that before. We already studied the momentum. I mean, Hamiltonian will come. But let's take a smaller step because I have something interesting to say about this momentum. Okay, I told you I'll do whatever you said because you're going to do this in your homework anyway. So that's the result. So what I want to ask is how many degrees of freedom do you think a Dirac field has, which is a four-dimensional complex spinner? So, 4D complex spinner. What do you think? How many degrees of freedom our Lagrangian, our field has?
Maybe eight.
Right. That's exactly what I was trying to lure you to say. Mm-hmm. Okay. 8 seems good to guess. 4 times 2 is 8. But now I have to ask you other questions. First, let's think about how many solutions do we have? We have some U, we have some V, that's it, right? That's the E to the minus IPX, then that's the other one. How many solutions do we have? I have a height index. What's that index?
Spinner index.
Oh, I have two, sorry. I height the two index.
And the spinner index.
Okay, very good. How many solutions do we have as a spinner, as a whole, like the whole four dimension? Four solutions, because there's spin. And this time the computation is even easier. It's 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, now I want to ask you about physics. Like really physics. And Dirac says, I want electron. I want the theory of electron, and that's what he wants, and he succeeded. So, but remember what he also discovered when he discovered electron. He find that there is no way to only have electron. He also discovered
positron.
Okay, very good. Now we can count how many different electron and positron do we have. Give you an electron. How many different kind of electron there are there? Mm-hmm. Just think about the electron first, but the positron is just sort of identical. How many electrons do we have?
Electrons are identical, right? They're identical particles.
Okay. They are, except they are labeled by spin. So 2 electron, 2 positron. 4. So it's becoming more and more convincing that the Dirac field shouldn't have 8 degrees of freedom. So what's going on? So let's go back to what David probably said. So let's see. Forget about a QFT for a moment. David says you have a point particle in 3 dimensions. How many degrees of freedom does it have? 3. A point particle, like me, moving in the 3 dimension, have 3 degrees of freedom. Did he tell you that how do you actually compute that as 3? Rather just say, it's 3 dimensional, it's 3 degrees of freedom. Did he talk about, he must talk about this. He says, whenever you have an X, you must have something to pair up. Yeah, to give you a phase space. So the interesting thing is that from classical mechanics, we know how many degrees of freedom is in X in a 3-dimensional system, and how many degrees of freedom is in the momentum. You have to add and divide it by 2 to get 3, which is, you're like, yes, what's your point? Of course, you add 2, 3 and divide by 2, you get 3. But now let's apply it to Dirac field. How many degrees of freedom is in the field? Well, as we said, it's 8. So 8 is right. But now you ask how many degrees of freedom is in the momentum. It's also 8. But one is Poisson, one is in Poisson Dagger.
So you can't divide by 2?
It means it has 8, but it's not independent. Because Poisson and Poisson Dagger has exactly the same degrees of freedom. There is nothing new we get from momentum. This is where all, you know, we take, what's it called? first order equation, things changed. Once you have Klein-Gordon Lagrangian, it has a square there, then you actually get something dot as your momentum. But this is not something dot. This is basically something. It's the same thing. So hence, we conclude in any method you count, the Dirac field has 4 degrees. So yes?
When we're doing that derivation at del psi, are we treating psi and psi dagger to be independent?
Psi and psi bar is what we treat it as independent. We do. Because that's how you get the equation of motion. You say, I'm just going to do it respect the psi bar equation of motion. That's why people pick this Lagrangian. It is extremely simple to get from the Lagrangian to the equation of motion. I mean, if people know how to have this to start with, of course, you can get everything you can get from the equation of motion. But this is, I mean, who would think of this, that there is a bar there, and it has a gamma zero hiding there.
So if we're treating them to be independent.
Yeah, you would also have.
Degrees of freedom, you're also, now you're treating them not to be independent.
That's right, because these are, that is the approach, because this is like A1, B1, A2, B2, A3, B3, A4, B4, and we say this contains exactly the same information. But as a field to assemble them all together, like you can, like, wait, don't you treat a phi and a phi dagger in complex scalar just like independent? You can get. The thing is, what makes sense if you actually go to try to get the other equation of motion, you will realize that those two equations of motion would be identical because they actually contain the same information. But this is still how we do it, just like how you do it in complex scalar theory.
I'm confused. Why are you treating your Lagrangian as being written in the phase space configurations? So
no, I'm not treating it in the phase space. I'm just saying this is the proper way of counting degrees of freedom. It has nothing to do with Lagrangians living somewhere. It just says if you want to count the degrees of freedom, the proper way is count your positions degrees of freedom, count your momentum's degrees of freedom, and average them.
And this psi is somehow encompassing both momentum and position?
Yeah, in some way. Because if you think about it, all the numbers, all the information is, it is A1, B1, A2, B2, A3, B3, A4, B4. Which is exactly here, except it might be an I minus sign or whatever.
Why is that the proper way to count your degrees of freedom? I mean, like
that's you should ask David, right? Okay. I wouldn't know the answer. Okay, so this is a very interesting thing. Okay, how many degrees of freedom are there in while? 2, because you cut it in half, and it's simpler. And there is another way to make a Dirac field easier in something like less degree freedom, and we'll see them on Monday tutorial. All right, what's the step 3? Last step is momentum. And the next step will be Hamiltonian. Some of you wants to put it as the first step, like this is so important. That's true. Hamiltonian is very important, and I'm gonna write something. It's slightly long, but I do hope you recognize it. Maybe, sort of. Yeah. So this is the Hamiltonian Dirac claims without a quantization. That's the classical Hamiltonian. Turns out the real Hamiltonian is just a sandwich, though. into some psi and psi. And what's the next step? If you have a Hamiltonian in terms of a field, you want to quantize it. How do I quantize it?
I don't know, do the mode expansion and then promote like the...
Very good, mode expansion, perfect. So I'll write the mode expansion of the Dirac field in the proper way, which is I'll write the coefficient first and then put the solution together. So it will properly look like a linear combination of solutions. Besides it looks complicated, this is the same idea as you have in scalar field. Except in scalar field, of course, you don't have that thing, the spinner thing. Okay? See, hopefully this is clear. This is the solution. And I put the coefficient in front. And I take time equals zero because Hamiltonian is conserved. Okay, I can just compute it at t equals zero. And what's the next thing to do?
Annihilation.
That's slightly later. So if I have the mode expansion, slightly later. I have a mode expansion, I have a field, and it has another field. What's the most?
Is there a reason why we're using B and C?
Star?
Why are we defining it like this?
So remember, you used to define in the scalar field, in the complex scalar, you have an A and a B star. And I can't tell you, okay, I can't tell you entirely using our knowledge from part two, but from part one, remember Weinberg argued that there has to be antiparticles, so we kind of use the same symbol for the antiparticle. So that's why there is a C that's different. And then remember, you have to combine the annihilation and creation so that the charge is always going up. At this point, all I can say is that because the solutions are different, we can't really expect the coefficient to be the same. And the other thing I can say is from the experience of the scalar field, we kind of want a thing and a star thing. So that would be how we think about it at this point. But mostly is because that we know there is antiparticle, which we'll see in this way too. I will not let you drawn with the idea about antiparticle. So I just need like later. So, I mean, it seems okay. Already forgot. Maybe somebody says the answer. If I have a psi and there's a psi and a psi dagger in my Hamiltonian, what's the most direct thing to do? Huh? Write a psi dagger and then? Yeah, just put them in, right? Put them in for substitution is what I want. Substitute all this thing in, which is called homework two, choice two. And there's even a song to go with it, that it's uploaded. Some of the you heard about it's the Alex, no, the other one. It's our Hamilton. The William Rowan Hamilton is his true name. So the song is pretty good. But anyway, dali 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 dala. And some pages later, I hope it's not too long. Okay. You want to check with your friends who are doing this together so that it's not too long. But the end result is this. And you will see it in the homework. Okay, don't trust the one on the board that much, but there is one in the notes. You should get this. Okay? What's the next thing? Yay, I have a Hamiltonian. It's already set. It's just now it's the next step to do it. What do we do? All promoter operators, because eigenstates come after when we have a operator. Okay, this is the part that I frowned at for years, and finally decided to read what Weinberger say about this promoting business. Okay, let's promote it. After promoting, okay, I decided to actually write it instead of do some sneaky things. Because it's very important, Hamiltonian. Just like all the other important, all the important Hamiltonian. So I wrote it, but the thing what happened is the star become a dagger and the P, before we have a function, now we have an operator, so we read it as a subscript. This should be the same as what you did in, like the notation change to show that. Now we have an operator. Perfect. And so what do we do next? What?
Commutation.
Okay. Pretend we don't know about anti-commutation. then we'll try to commute and then we claim, okay, that we're just going to normal order this part. And they say, I switch them, right? That's what we say about normal ordering. Is we want to the creation first and annihilation second. So now let's all stare at this expression and tell me what's not so good about it. First, I'll use some new notation. Step 5 is normal ordering. And I will use the definition from harmonic oscillator. So what is this called? Number. So very good. We have this, and we have number for B, number for C. So what is so not satisfying about this thing? It seems it tells us if I create more C particles, I lower my energy. This is called the perpetual machine. We just created a perpetual machine. So, oh, you can just produce C particles and you gain so much energy, and the energy is dropping. So this is really not good. This is, in other words, the Hamiltonian is not bounded below. You can just create a bunch of C particles. So then we get a big no. And then the other thing we can try is anti-commutator. Why would that save us? So let's see. I'm just going to look at this problematic part. Suppose I have an anti-commutator, so I can subtract this term. Okay, I'll ignore the spin index for now. I can subtract a term to combine into an anti-commutator, but the price is, of course, added back. And this I happily identified as the anti-commutator. And here is, I invented a new notation just like this morning, because I don't want to write this again and again. So this is called the dense normalization thing. So I'll write it once, what's hidden in there. So all very familiar things, 2 pi's and 2 e's and delta. This is really killing me that I have to write it so many times. So it's whatever the scalar commutator is, and then you just add the last little bit because we have spin.
Is that in D and P and
what? So this, no, the D, sorry, that's a D too. And I was having too much fun, so I was like, says, I can have a DAN, a normalization. And then you can have an acrim then. But anyway, it's just his, that his normalization is very good, but it's very long. And I refuse to write them. And it's, why is that true? I'll show you later. So this normalization is so good that you never have to care about them. It, when you do a commutator, you always end up having an integral, the dv, the volume thing. It's exactly the same thing. They all cancel. So if you just write it okay, like that way, you'll be good. I don't know it works in other normalization, but this normalization, they always cancel. OK. Of course, the point is now we have a plus sign here. And oh, sorry. So I should write it, it's minus sign. I can probably safely write it as minus infinity plus this term. Huh? This is clearly infinity right there. It's not gonna, it's just like the normal, before you do normal ordering that then has a plus infinity, we have a minus infinity. I mean. Okay, I will say something about it, but I just want to say our goal is achieved. We flipped that sign, and happy ending. And you were like, "I'm not happy. There's a negative infinity in front." And well, I mean, you remember dense carpet, and we can sweep those infinity in, and that's what we do. But okay. Okay, I'll let me say a little bit about this. So this is something, of course, calculated because you didn't take a cutoff, you didn't do a normalization, so it's plus infinity, minus infinity. But people, actually, you know those people, Savas, like a Mina's supervisor, and you always say there's somebody is talking to Mina. Okay, also known as the father of supersymmetry. So the idea is you have plus infinity from scalar field, minus infinity from fermion field. And the idea is if every fermion is paired with boson, and make sure that they are exactly identical except now it's a boson, and then which called the super partners, then this infinity will cancel. And that will explain why that our word is Minkowski, except it's not. So if Susie was very successful, But then they measure the cosmology constant or like crap. but it's still very successful. Supersymmetry we have already discovered half of the particles supersymmetry predict. The half, we are the particles they discover. And the zero of the superpartners. So half. Okay. So the next, we are almost,
What happened to the minus infinity?
Huh?
What happened to the minus infinity?
Hopefully canceled by the bosons plus infinity. That's the hope. And we even hope everything cancels out and you get something. It's called a cosmology constant. And that method will get you off by 10 to the 120. It's just like we expect one and we measured something like that. But anyway, 10 to the 120. So, but don't ask me about the cosmology constant. There were many people trying to solve that problem in this building, not me.
What do you mean add minus infinity with plus infinity? What does that even mean?
Because they're doing randomization. If you take some cutoff, do some dimension, then they will be finite. That's the last lecture. Okay, let's not jump into it. We will try to see that how things will become finite or still stay infinity, but then we claim that that's not what I observed, so that's fine. But anyway, back to field. Okay. I think it's. Oh, wait. No. Last thing, so basically, when this normal ordering, we want to define our normal ordering too, right? That means it cannot be the same as the scalar case. If it's the same, we go back to our original problem. So what's the important thing about the normal ordering? Minus sign. We need it. Okay, so from today onward, you will see a bunch of minus signs. Pay attention to them if they come from the fact that we study a fermion instead of boson, then they are important. And Amalia has like the best story about the minus sign. And at some point, like she shows me, So you, I also want you to collect these minus signs because remember, in the interview at some point it says I could just randomly point to a minus sign you show me as this. Where does it come from? Why there is a minus sign? And try not to miss any those minus signs. Some minus signs are more important than the other minus signs. And this is the time you need to start pay attention. This minus sign, I mean, the first minus sign, of course, is coming from the anti-commutator compared to the boson. You are using a different commutator, so you have a minus sign there. And that minus sign propagates, and it says you have to do different normal ordering. Okay, I'll say one last thing, and then we will have a break. The one last thing is that, okay, two things. First thing is all, there's a similar one for the B, but then all the other anti-commutator vanish, just like when you learned in the scalar theory, it's really just the one has a dagger has something, and the rest are just zero. So there are two not vanish because we have two particle, there's B and there's C. Okay, and the rest vanish, and if you have that, and let's go back to field, and you would discover that. Wait, sorry. What do you discover? I say. I have this anti. We figure out all the anti-commutator relationship of the C and the Bs. And I say, I want to go back to my field expansion. What do you expect? Okay, let me remind you. What do you see in the scalar field case What's the first commutator relationship you see from the scalar case? The very first. Phi and pi. And from here, you get A and A dagger. But in our case, is the other way. Now we get C and B's. What do you think is psi? This thing will be. You will get. See, this is psi, and this is pi for psi, right? What would you get? A third function. Huh. That's very bad. I'll add this back. And what am I missing? At this point, we're still in 3D, so I'll add some arrows because it's called some equal time commutator. We have an equal time anti-commutator. What am I missing? It's related to your monster identities.
Some spinner index.
This is something we can't just get rid of because they are, one is a spinner and one is a spinner lying down. It doesn't make any sense without a spinner index. And again, all the others vanish. Like a psi, psi, psi dagger, they all vanish. Okay, so that, yeah?
Here the pi is not
this pi.
Independent variable to the psi, right? If we count the degrees of freedom, the tree is independent.
So the degrees of freedom is literally, I think I should have just write it down. This. And you say you count all the A's and the B's, theirs are the real degrees of freedom that will describe psi. It's just like a psi bar can be treated as a independent field as psi, all in your scalar theory, phi star can be treated as independent of phi. There's no problem doing so. You can just say that they shared it, and remember the real degrees of four is 4 degrees. You can say there are 4 here and 4 there. After all, you're just doing linear combination of things. It's sometimes like in complex analysis, if you have a plus IB and you treated a minus IB as independent, that's fine. Because before A and B is independent, and now this thing and that thing is independent.
But it feels like our phase space is constrained right now.
What?
Our phase space.
Our phase space is still 8 degrees of freedom. There's nothing we did differently. Right? You can either say there is 8 here, 0 here, and you can say 0 there and 8 there, and you can also say there's 4 here and 4 there. No matter how you separate them, you have 8 dimension in your phase space.
It is a constrained subspace of 16 dimension.
Well, that's right. If you insist to start with 16 dimension, then yeah, there is a constraint. Says there are only 8 left. Okay. So, all right. We've done a lot, and then we quantized the Dirac field. So this is the time I want to take a break. Just in case that we need a more mental break. So I'll show you something cool, okay? So by this time, it's a very, very hard question to ask. By this time, we have some commutator relationship, some anti-commutator relationship, which is differ by a minus sign. It's a very important minus sign. It's going to propagate for the rest of our class at the minus sign. But then some people ask an interesting question. Says, didn't I have this?
Wait, what's that?
It's a minus sign. Sorry. And then you're like, why pi, right? Why don't you be more ambitious and let that pi turn into theta? So, right? Ooh, some Pandora's box would be open. So last year I was teaching path integral, and I did this demo, and they really like it. So I'd like to do it for you. It's okay, you haven't taken path integral. The most important part you remember about this demo is a path is important. The path of some particle is important. Okay, that's all you need from path integral. So I'm trying to explain about all these statistics. And all these statistics has something to do with swapping. You're swapping two particles, then you ask what's the statistic, right? So in order for my demonstration to make sense, oh crap, I didn't make the other demonstration. I'll just have to go. Okay. Never mind. Somehow I only made half. The point is that instead of tracking the movement of both particles, I can just track the distance between them. That's fine. And then, which means in this reference frame, I only need one vector in the three dimension to describe the two particles, the distance. And then when we say swapping, we meant flip. Flipping the vector, right? If you swap to the two particles, then you get a flapping vector. And now you say these two particles are identical, just means I'm identifying the two dots in the opposite direction. Okay. I mean, this is completely unrelated. Not completely unrelated, but it's about a commutator and an anti-commutator. So it's somewhat related. So what I claim is that, see, this is a three-dimensional space. And I claim, because you are studying identical particles, really it's only a half semisphere, because opposite ends are identical, right? So now I'm going, which means because of the identical particles, the topology of this space has been changed because of the identification. So now I'm going to show you how they are changed. Because we're talking about the topology. The only thing I remembered about topology is that if I want to study topology, I want a loop. like it's either shrinking to zero or not. Like a donut doesn't shrink. And if there's no hole in the middle, then you don't shrink. And if you have a hole, then you don't shrink. That's what I know about topology. Like a ball, in a ball, if you have any loop, it will shrink. But if you have a loop on the donut, you kind of shrink them on the donut.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a donut, a mug, and all sorts of other things. So I'll show you the first example of the loop, which is exceedingly simple. I have a loop, and it can shrink, right? The trivial topology. I draw a loop in my space. Remember, this is actually three dimensions. Like it's, I have a ball to hold it, but really it's the entire space, but cut in half. And there is a hole in the center. It's like the because that we don't want to the two particles to be identical, to be like, we don't want that vector to be zero. We don't want two particles on top of each other. We don't know how to study those things. That's where all this infinity comes. So let me show you this. So this is called a boson. So let me show you the other topology. And indeed, it falls apart. Okay, so this loop can't shrink. It's still a loop because we identified the opposite line. It's a loop, and it doesn't shrink. It doesn't go through the center. This is the beginning. This is the end. But it's a loop because those two points are identified. Remember? You have identical particle. You would never know.
Oh, okay.
And this is called a fermion. And I can even show you this four in parts. But let me try. What I can even show you is that I can try to go back. I can add another fermion loop. And then you realize if you complete this loop from the other side, now again you are a shrinkable loop. So this is the fermion. Y2 fermion is like a boson. And so basically I'm saying this topology of this hot hemisphere has only two different loops. One loop is trivial, the other loop is half of the trivial. As long as you do another double. So of course I have a tutorial to go with this if you are interested to know what exactly goes on after you learn past integral from Francois. But here, okay, I need a volunteer. You are my volunteer. Okay, what I need you to do. So now we're gonna go to 2D. In 2D, I have the luxury of show you a space-time demonstration. So this is time, and this is space. And basically, Sergen is gonna be my space. So this is where two particle is. So instead of drawing all this vector and showing what's between, I can actually see what's going on when I swap particle. I swap. You keep getting new things. So you can swap once, swap twice, you don't go back. It's not a fermion case. You can just keep swapping, and this is called a braiding. And apparently braiding is some like mathematician things. But this thing that braids is called an anneal. And this is exactly this. Because you can braid as many things you want, and it'll only happen in 2D, because 2D has a different topology than 3. Okay. If you like, you can ask me later about the real proof, the calculation that accompany that. But that's a interesting topology interpretation of boson, fermion, and anneals. All right, so back where we are. We quantize it and we finish all the steps that Dan told us about. So what do we do now? What did you do in scalar field after you get the operators, you get the commutators, what's the next thing? Exactly. What are they called? The we got some operators and the SAPA says it would be good to know where the operator is acting. Yeah? Where are they acting? Vacuum. Vacuum is good. I like vacuum. We'll go with vacuum. Right? The next thing is states. See, now we finally completed the loop of the chicken to egg and egg to chicken. States. So it's at this point the canonical quantization says, okay, let's figure out where this operator acting. So vacuum is the same, right? Vacuum is vacuum. And a wet vacuum is very nicely normalized. And the vacuum is very nicely, okay, this will ask you. So if we use our normal ordered Hamiltonian to act on vacuum, what do we get? Zero. Good. Vacuum supposed to be have zero energy. Okay, so now we can do one particle states. Oh, we got our states. And you're like, what about C? I don't know. Like, people try to do funny things, but normally what they do is to get write a whole bar on it. Just to distinguish this is the B particle, this is a C particle. And you know, then you ask, what are the normalized? It's the same as before. Whatever Dan write for you is still good, and you add this. Okay. So now I'm gonna write a two particle case. And what am I missing? I swept my two particles. Minus sign. There's just a bunch of minus signs. You have to pay attention. Now I have two identical particles. What should I get?
Zero.
So this is called the Pauli exclusion principle, and this is called the fermion statistic. All coming from your anti-commutators. Okay, so I think we should discuss where what are the B's and the C's. I'll stay over. And what are the B's and the C's, right? I mean, we attempted to call them particle and antiparticle, but are we entitled? If you watched the Noether theorem video, you would know that, well, first, let's check this is a symmetry. It's just a number. All of things are number. We can see if psi goes this way, and if they are all number, the psi bar will go the other way. They will cancel. And if you watch the Noether theorem video, you will be able to compute this cart. It's not a one-line computation. And what we know is that the thing is a vector, so that's actually good. And we know current is a vector, and it turns out that's what it is. That's the current. Okay, so now we can compute the charge. The charge is the first component of the zero component of the current, and if I integrate it over space, and that'll give me a charge, conserved charge. Suppose we'll study electrons, then we'll have. And notice there's gamma zero coming from the bar, but the gamma zero from the zero's component, they actually cancel. And then this is where Dirac did his computation, he's happy. He says, oh, psi dagger, psi, that's a nice density. It's always positive. Mm-hmm. And guess what? We're not happy. No, this is very bad. We're like, oh, I have some electrons and positrons. I want to measure the total charge. And it says it's always positive. I can just take like two positrons. No electron says why the charge would be always positive. So this makes Dirac very happy, but we're not. But nevertheless, we can do the same thing, da 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 da, lots of calculation. And here is the result of that. It's a very similar computation. Well, it's a short computation, much shorter than the one you're going to do in your homework. So you're not required to do this calculation. Just have the belief that this is the results because I took it. Otherwise, you can look it up. It's in the notes, and then you can do this computation. Once you get very familiar with getting psi and the psi dagger together and blah, you will have this. And so, are we happy? I know we're not happy, but is there? We were not happy, but stare at this expression and see if there's any chance we can be happy. Norm ordering. This is not a normal order. Let's normal order this thing. And what we get is NB minus N and yet another minus sign. And this minus sign is very important. It tells me that a C particle carries a negative charge compared to B particle. And that's why we call them antiparticle of each other. Oh, okay. Maybe I should write here. Now we're happy. We should always have a happy ending. At least for me. I get very troubled when I watch a movie that doesn't have a happy ending.
Yeah, me too.
It's just another opinion,
Dora. Normal ordering means you always swap infinity in the bucket. The whole business about a normal ordering can be known as the magic carpet that ties infinities. And okay, so remember that at some point I promise that the anti-commutator is okay, even if causality wants commutator.
Sorry, can I interrupt you?
Yeah.
What was the motivation of us doing the normal ordering here? What?
No. That's the motivation. Once you have the motivation, you decided that everything should be normal order.
Why
do we do it? Because like now, if you look at the line. I wonder before
I decease if I will like
the technology. I can just and my arm goes up. Anyway. This is where we're not happy because a psi dagger psi is always positive. Do we want our charge always positive if we have positron? No.
Well,
we want a negative charge somehow.
After you get the minus sign there, you shouldn't be surprised and say, oh, that's a particle because we imposed it before. We said positron
has
a charge. So when we see that, we're not going to be surprised.
Yeah. We shouldn't be surprised. It's like a sanity check. Yes, we impose that, but we impose the normal ordering is not because of that. It's because that's the perpetual machine that you don't want to build because you are not going to build it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understood the reasoning for Lagrangian to work, I mean, for the Hamiltonian, we say that because the energy levels.
But.
So it doesn't matter if we ignore it, the infinite.
Yeah.
But for the Q, how do we ignore the infinite?
I mean,
it's like, are we throwing away the charge of the direct electrons or something?
That's what I was about to say, that the Dirac C has this crazy amount of charge, which is very bad. Like, if you think about it, our universe has a background of minus infinity charge, then it's not gravity. The charge builds up. It's getting worse. Gravity, it will be bad too, but the charge builds up and the things will be attracted by it and we don't know about it. And I'm just very confused. Nobody helped me to erase board except Louis, but this person who is in charge of doing it is not doing it on Friday. And now I was kicked out. No, I'm just not happy because on Friday, three Fridays in a row, there's nobody erasing. Okay. But anyway, so yeah, okay, we're not happy about the infinities in the charge. Yeah, okay. I'll figure out why we can throw them away. Okay. At this point, it's a standard procedure. Once you realize you have the norm order, then you norm order with everything. But I'll check. I don't remember people anymore, so I have to write it down. So it's just he asked the question. What would we do? All these minus infinities. So causality. The idea is, see, Poisson is not very good. Poisson is not very good. But Poisson is not good for observable because it's not, it carries the spinner index, and we believe we can't turn spinner into a good observable, like something we can do in the experiment, because nobody ever finds in the experiment says, oh, this thing turned to 2 pi and someone pick up a minus sign. That's Tang's explanation, which means we would ever care. Is pairs of size. This will be much clearer once we go to Monday. But so far we know, you have a psi bar gamma psi for the Lagrangian. You have a mass term. You have a derivative terms. If you strip off all those gamma away, and then look at what this becomes. It becomes this. It's not really important to keep track of all these things, indexes and whatever. The only thing important is the anti-commutator shows up. If you somehow shows the anti-commutator vanish outside the light cone, the space-like, then you will show it's okay. This commutator will also vanish, which corresponding to those things you swap in the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this gives us a motivation to study this object of this anti-commutator. And I even remembered my spinner in this. Okay, so this is just the propagator, but it's not your Feynman propagator because we don't have time ordering. We haven't done our LSZ stuff. This is just the propagator, what you previously know as dx minus y. Now the three integral of this thing to e to the, I should write it. It's the three integral of the this. So it's the fermion version of that. It's this thing is like no time ordering. And this is a similar thing. And so this computation would be also easier than your Hamiltonian computation. I'll just tell you what you need to be wary about is first, when you build a psi bar, change all labels. So psi, you use some S and P and psi bar, you use R and a Q, and psi is at X, psi bar is at Y, just keep track all these index labels. And then, and the second is I ask you be confident. Those dense normalization will all cancel out. Be confident that if you have a commutator and then you meet a this together, it comes with a dense normalization, there's a dense normalizer downstairs, you always can. Okay, if they pair up, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to try to say, oh my god, we will have to open all this crazy notation to find the thing. They will cancel. And
what do you mean by change?
So if you write a psi and you write the psi bar, for example, if you look at that psi, and it has like a spin index S and a momentum integral P. So when you write a psi bar, you want to change to something like different R or Q.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, because you're gonna facing a lot of index, and it's really important to keep track of them. And often after these things, what happens that is you convert some new labels to the old labels and the stuff. But sometimes, you know, they might be converting with a minus sign or whatever. Sometimes might be a minus sign. You know, R to S is not possible, but for the momentum delta, it might be. So it's good to always keep track of them. And the last thing is during your computation of the Hamiltonian, you will realize really UP is not that useful. And look up identities. This is the important part. Like, you need to be able to just look at what you have in the computation, open the book, find the identity, and do that substitution without caring where that identity comes from. Or you can do check one. I mean, it's all showed in the appendix. You can look at. Can look at a couple and do one, you will realize that right. It's certainly not worth the time to prove all the identities, which I did. And the point is, after all dust settles, this is fewer dust than your Hamiltonian calculation. That's why that's the one I want you to do. Once you do that, you can confidently say that I'm good at doing any of this. Now, the Hamiltonian one is a little complicated because you have to use the equation of motion. But when you do your Hamiltonian thing, remember the Dirac. I'll just write it. This thing, might be useful. But in the end, all that settles. You expand both things and you write them out and you do your anti-commutator and you cancel out to some integrals with your deltas. When all that's settled, this is the propagator you're looking at.
Wait, is that that's equal to the commutator?
This is the anti-commutator. Yeah. So basically, you will get your scalar results, and you get the Dirac operator, which is not too surprising. Like, it's sort of, not actually, it's the other operator X thing on Dirac. But if you are not happy, you can always look at notes and do this derivation. I would say I recommend doing this particular computation as a warm-up for your homework.
So where did the derivative come from?
Very good question. That's because at some point, the U is going to meet a U bar. And this identity, if you look it up, it's this. And since we are having something like this, you can turn momentum into derivative. And why would you do that? Well, because the previous result doesn't look as cute as this. Also because if you put, you do all your effort to turn, so I think, I don't know, I think on the notes it might be a 5 or 6 line cut. And the point is, you see this. Now what does that tell? Remember this thing? What's the most important property of this thing? For me, the most. It's even at a space like. Even at a space like. Which means this anti-commutator is even at, it's zero at a space like, which means the causality is saved. Okay, then we're done. This is called a 1 day before interaction. Dan wants to call it the day before storm. we brainstorm a bunch of names this morning. And I also tell Dan that I want to call it a you will be back because you are throughout the whole day with me. And then we'll be back on Tuesday throughout the whole day with us because the LSD. Right? Okay, this is not much more complicated than the scalar case you have. It's exactly the same stuff. The most important thing out of this whole lecture is remember the minus signs. They will come back later. There are even more minus signs. And if you keep track of all this minus sign, it is all because the Hamiltonian. Because the Hamiltonian you're going to find is unbounded below.
Oh, no.
Then you use all this minus signs. So, yeah, no, I really think it could be a interesting axis, or even the Q one, the charge one. But this one might be even more, no, not this. The charge one might be also interesting. Like that one would be really an easier version of your. That one might become more complicated, all this outer product. Yes.
And that's why I think the Hamiltonian is the most important thing to compute.